The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com. And
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Once the hallmark of sailors, gang members, and convicts, tattoos are now mainstream. A 2012 Harris Interactive poll found that one in five American adults has a tattoo, and associations with deviance and criminality has diminished. 75% of those surveyed said having a tattoo didn't make a difference in what they thought about someone's likely behavior. Still, tattoos are considered unacceptable in many workplaces outside of the creative fields. But that is changing, as the recent allowance of some visible tattoos on the arms of Manchester, New Hampshire police officers attests. Beverly Yin Thompson is Associate Professor of Sociology at Siena College and author of Covered in Ink, Tattoos, Women, and the Politics of the Body. Beverly, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Now, most of us are or know people with a couple of tattoos, but your book focuses heavily on women and heavily tattooed people. Now, what does heavily tattooed mean to you?
Well, it's common for a lot of people just to have one tattoo, maybe two tattoos, but being heavily tattooed means that you've collected enough tattoos that it starts to create some friction in your life. And especially for women, often they have to keep their tattoos small, cute, and hidden, as I like to say. And so things that kind of go beyond those boundaries are what I call heavily tattooed, when people have tattoos on what is called public skin, like their forearms, their hands, their neck. When women especially have images that are not feminine, but perhaps, you know, like more monsters or dragons or stuff like that, that's more heavily tattooed. And so having a tattoo for a woman, having one small tattoo is not transgressive, but being heavily tattooed is when women start to get transgressive with their ink collection.
Do you think women face more discrimination or judgment for tattoos?
Yeah, absolutely. Because historically, tattoos are associated with men and masculinity and very masculine subcultures, like you mentioned just now with the bikers, criminals, stuff like that. There's that kind of stigma. And so for men to have tattoos, they're just reinforcing their masculinity. But for women to have tattoos, they're negating their femininity. And so that's where the social static starts to come in.
Not only negating femininity, but, you know, we've heard the term tramp stamp. There's this idea that certain kind of women get tattoos.
Exactly. And so there's that historical stigma and association that women who have tattoos are perhaps biker chicks or sexually promiscuous or prostitutes, sex workers, stuff like that. I don't find that association within the literature historically, but there is socially that kind of stigma. And so women can be stigmatized in that way. And that term, it's demeaning and stereotypical, but it shows you that kind of historical stigma that is still lingering.
A woman named Jane Marie, she recently kicked up quite a storm. Now, she wrote in Jezebel about being refused a neck tattoo. Now, this is at one of Manhattan's hippest tattoo joints. Says it was sexism, but a number of tattoo artists are firing back and say that it's part of their code to err on the side of caution. What do you think went on there?
I mean, a tattoo artist, it's up to them and their judgment of whether they want to do a tattoo. You know, they don't just have to do any tattoo that walks through the door. And so a tattoo artist, a responsible one, is going to tell someone the kind of repercussions that are going to come along with collecting a tattoo like that. And so just historically within the tattoo culture, it's assumed that once you've really collected a lot of tattoos over your whole body, then that's when you appropriately start to put tattoos on public skin. And once you start putting tattoos in places that are always visible, that's really going to have huge repercussions for your life socially, for your jobs, for your family, and so on. So any tattoo artist can say that, you know, this is not a good idea, especially for someone who's not fully tattooed already and might not understand or already feel the repercussions of their tattooing. So I think that tattoo artist was very responsible and well within the proper etiquette for tattoo artists.
Well, let's talk about public skin and work. In Manchester, New Hampshire, we mentioned the police force recently changed its tattoo policy, and they're allowing some visible tattoos on officers' arms subject to review, but still nothing allowed on the face or the hands or the neck. Are these still considered job stoppers?
Yeah, absolutely. This sounds a lot like the military regulations that they have within the Army. And those are updated frequently based on the cultural changes. But there's just this assumption that these are public servants. They want this uniform kind of appearance. And so a lot of rules and regulations are alive and well within the workplace, especially in the military like that. You might have school uniforms. And then plenty of jobs and employers have their own kind of dress codes. And this is well within the legal rights of the employers.
In the Manchester Police Force, it is content that's subject to review. What are some of the content that people find so offensive?
You might have racist tattoos, sexist tattoos, you know, anything that could offend the public. I mean, for these kind of workers, you want them to have tattoos that are just not going to have those kinds of responses from the public. So nothing that's touching on any kind of social issue like that.
Beverly Yen Thompson is with us. She's a professor of sociology and has written a book called Covered in Ink, Tattoos, Women, and the Politics of the Body. Outside of the tattoo industry, a number of other industries are accepting tattoos or seeing them even as assets. What are some of those industries and companies that are now allowing tattooed people with pretty much impunity?
Like you mentioned earlier, I think it's more the creative kinds of work environments. We see a lot of tattoos on hairdressers, restaurant workers, sushi chefs, perhaps. So you do see some, but it's really highly contingent on the environment that you find them in.
Well, you're a professor of sociology. How do people react to your tattoos in an academic setting?
Academia is a conservative work environment in general, and I think that my generation is definitely changing things. A lot of folks my age or a lot of graduate students are starting to have tattoos, but the older generation of faculty, you don't see as many with tattoos like those who are in their 60s or 50s. So it's definitely a generational thing, but it also is heavily dependent on the atmosphere of that particular school, that particular geographic area, and so on. And so for me personally, I've worked at three different types of schools and three different geographical areas. I've worked in Miami, Florida, North Texas, and now here in Albany, New York. But my school right now is, I work at a Catholic liberal arts school, and so it is more of a conservative environment. And just the general expectation of what professors dress like, you know, it's very formal and suits and stuff like that. So a lot of people are just covered up with their tattoos if they have any.
So what have you got for tattoos?
I have two half sleeves, and then I have an entire back piece. I've got a lot of tattoos, but I still haven't entered that public skin yet also, so it's easy for me to hide my tattoos. And living in Albany, New York, also, it's very easy to hide tattoos as well because it's very cold up here.
But in the summer when you're wearing short sleeves or sleeveless shirts or whatever, what do people say to you about your tattoos? You seem pretty offended by the way that a lot of people approach them.
When you have visible tattoos, you're going to get approached, you're going to get commented on. So that's just something that you have to deal with. Some people are more open to that. I happen to be more introverted and more shy about that kind of stuff. And so I don't really like comments on my tattoos, but I certainly get them and I take them as they come. For me personally, it's mostly benign. People don't say very negative things or stuff like that, but plenty of my interviewees have gotten lots of negative comments.
Well, you do offer some etiquette tips for those who are viewing tattoos, but seem offended by some who ask or comment. But if someone's covered with tattoos and they are exposing that in public skin, shouldn't they expect that? I mean, are people not supposed to look, not supposed to respond?
Yeah, it's definitely expected. But I think what's interesting with a lot of my participants is they didn't expect the extent of it. But I would just ask, you know, what is that person really trying to say? Because some comments are unnecessary and some comments make sense. Like, for example, a lot of comments are just to say, oh, I notice you have a tattoo. Well, that's not needed, you know, to be vocalized. But if you have a really specific reason why you're asking about the tattoos, like, oh, I really like that style, I would like to get a tattoo like that, who's your artist, then that makes more sense. So it's more just the context of what is this question really trying to say.
As more people who have tattoos find their way into the workforce, it's probably going to be, like the Manchester, New Hampshire police, a matter of policy in some places. And I'm thinking about content that makes people uncomfortable in a similar way to off-color jokes might make people uncomfortable. Do you think there should be policies about that in the same way that there are policies about offensive language or jokes?
I personally would prefer there to be less policies about tattoos, but certainly we live in a world where there's lots and lots of policies regulating how people look in the job. And so, you know, it's just smart for people to really think ahead. You just never know what's going to come in your future. And so to be cautious about collecting tattoos and to be able to cover up when necessary.
So no job stoppers, as you call them, nothing on your hands, neck, face.
Right. That would be most advisable.
Well, Beverly, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Beverly Yen Thompson, she's a tenured associate professor of sociology at Siena College and author of Covered in Ink, Tattoos, Women, and the Politics of the Body. You'll find a link to read more at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, we mentioned the online flap over the woman who was refused a neck tattoo at a New York tattoo shop. Apparently, there is a code among artists against inking the hands or necks or faces of people who are not already heavily tatted up. Word of Mouth producers Megan Tan and Molly Donahue went to Capital City Tattoo, that's here in Concord, New Hampshire, to speak with some of the artists there about who is ultimately responsible for choosing where and what to ink.
Hi.
So, to be honest, nobody on Word of Mouth has a tattoo, at least that we know of.
And when we think about tattoos, we all have an image of that one kid in that band that you used to hang out with.
Oh, yeah, I like that kid.
Or didn't hang out with.
Yeah, I do remember that kid.
Either way, you don't think of a tattoo as being especially hard to get.
Of course not.
But it can be. And of all the people you would think would encourage getting a tattoo, a tattoo artist would be pretty high on that list.
Of course. I mean, they want to make money, right?
But tattoo artists are actually sometimes more cautious than their clients.
Really?
Typically, I strongly frown upon any of my artists in here tattooing above the neck or below the wrist without prior existing tattoos or solid employment. I mean, if it's somebody who owns a construction company, and they're well established, they're not worried about anything, then it's on them.
That's Scott Flanders. He owns Capital City Tattoo, and those rules seem pretty standard for the artists we spoke with. A couple of questions they ask are, is this person already heavily tattooed? And do they have a solid job where new tattoos may be detrimental?
You get a tattoo on your neck, hands, or face. I think you have to earn those. We call them job stoppers.
That's Ryan Thomas. He's an artist at Capital City Tattoo. Another artist there, Derek DeLine, agrees.
You know, if you go to court for a speeding ticket and you have your neck tattooed, unfortunately, you still kind of get put in a category of someone that's probably a troublemaker or criminal, you know.
But sometimes that's exactly what people are looking for, a way to set themselves apart. All the tattoo artists at Capital City Tattoo have a lot of tattoos.
Not all of them have job-stopping tattoos, ink on their hands or above the collar, but Ryan does.
I got mine on purpose. To make sure I stayed in art because I had given up on it.
His tattoos are a permanent reminder of what he wants to do with his life, and they might make a midlife career change hard. Still, all these artists are professionals.
You know, it's not rowdy and drunk in here. There's not people partying in here. You know, this is an office.
Do you feel that sort of this more professional approach to tattooing, is that new or is it just something
It's more artists getting in the industry and becoming involved than it was like the old bikers and tough guys that thought it was cool. It's a very art-driven industry right now.
They have apprentices. They go to professional conventions and they have offices.
And just like a plastic surgeon is allowed to turn down a procedure they're not comfortable with, a tattoo artist is also allowed to turn down a job they don't want to be responsible for.
Do you feel like it's an ethical thing not letting or suggesting that people don't get tattoos that you feel they might regret?
Kind of. I mean, I'm the one doing it. A lot of people are like, it's my body, but that's my artwork. And any person that asks you who did it, you're going to say my name. That puts all responsibility on me.
Despite that responsibility and the weight of wearing someone's resume on your skin, some artists do agree that ultimately the choice remains with the client.
I'm not going to tell someone that they absolutely can't do something. It's their body. Some of the artists feel different. I myself am more into making the person comfortable, and I'm not the one to say, you know, don't get a neck tattoo.
If someone is determined to get that job-stopping tattoo, they will find someone to do it. It just may be a little bit more difficult than it was 15 years ago. But as Ryan reminds us,
everyone gets the tattoo they deserve.
Beautiful tats all over my back. Makes me so proud, I'm gonna shout it out loud. I got another tattoo.
And that story was brought to us by Word of Mouth producers Megan Tan and Molly Donahue.
Show the moment that I get undressed. At every job interview, they're just so impressed. Cause I got all my ex-wives on my chest. Over here is Clay Aiken.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you think grocery store checkout lines are too long now, imagine when clerks had to ring in everything by hand. No laser scanner, no computer, no barcode. Roman Mars of the podcast 99% Invisible brings us the story of the man who invented that little black square you didn't know you were taking for granted.
This sound is unmistakable.
Maybe you find it kind of lulling, like I do, since it signifies the end of a trip to the grocery store.
That's our new producer, Katie Mingle. I myself find that sound a bit anxiety-inducing, since it's also the sound of the total that I'm going to have to pay going up and up and up.
When I go to the grocery store and check out, I don't tell the checkout people. My wife always did. My husband here is the one that invented that barcode. And they just kind of look at you as if to say, you mean there was a time they didn't have a barcode?
It's hard to imagine now, a world without barcodes, a world without George Lohrer.
Well, hello. I'm George J. Lohrer. I'm the one that invented the UPC barcode and symbol in 1973.
Now, some of you might be saying to yourselves, I thought Joseph Woodland invented the barcode.
And if you're saying that to yourself, you are a nerd, and I love you for it. And just hold your nerd horses, because we're getting to Woodland right now.
In 1948, Joseph Woodland was trying to come up with a symbol that, when scanned, would translate to a number that a computer could use to identify a product. This would move people more quickly through the checkout line, which was a place where grocery stores felt they were losing money. So one day, the legend goes, Woodland's sitting on the beach drawing circles in the sand and thinking about Morse code. Instead of dot, 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 dash, 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 he thinks, I can use skinny and wide lines.
Bullseye.
Bullseye. The very first barcodes were in the shape of a bullseye.
That was 1948. And then for about 20 years, the bullseye idea gathered dust. The scanners and other equipment needed to put the system in place were just too expensive for any of it to be feasible.
Fast forward to 1973. The technology is now a bit more affordable, and a group of supermarket executives are like, okay, barcode or bust, we're doing this. So they put together a list of qualities that their ideal barcode would have and asked 14 different companies to come up with a proposal.
Could be no larger than 1.5 square inches, had to be omnidirectional.
That's George Lohrer again. He was working at IBM at the time, which was one of the companies competing to make the best barcode. And he looked long and hard at Woodland's design and didn't think it would work.
I couldn't support that as the solution to what the grocery industry wanted, because To me, there was no way that it would fulfill their specifications. My integrity just would not let me come up with a bunch of bull.
So George went back to the drawing table.
My wife said I came back and I would work on it day and night. Most of us was thinking, arithmetic, trying to prove that this would work. Also, I have to admit, I had to disprove that some of the others wouldn't work.
He ultimately came up with a rectangular barcode that fit more code into less space. Even Joe Woodland thought George's rectangular barcode was better.
Joe Woodland was very enthusiastic. He worked with me. In fact, he wrote the actual proposal for the submission to the grocery industry.
The Symbol Selection Committee unanimously voted for George Lohrer's rectangular symbol and code. They called it the Universal Product Code, or UPC. And a year later, in 1974, a pack of Wrigley's chewing gum became the first item to ever be scanned with the UPC barcode.
When barcodes became the standard, they didn't just make checkout lines faster. They allowed stores to keep track of huge amounts of inventory and to collect data on what we were buying.
It's estimated that there are now around 5 billion UPC barcodes scanned every day around the world.
We thought it would stay just within the grocery industry. We had no idea how far it was going to go.
And that was Roman Mars from the podcast 99% Invisible.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We have Siri to write our emails, online calendars to coordinate our schedules, and GPS to find our way. And still, we make lists. Whether written or typed, lists are sometimes practical, sometimes aspirational, and if viewed by anyone else, always revealing. Sean Usher is fascinated by what these private fragments tell us about their makers. We spoke to him when his riveting collection, Letters of Note, was published. Now the author and curator is out with Lists of Note, an eclectic collection deserving of a wider audience. It's a coffee table style book with images of more than 100 lists, from the record of accused Salem witches dated 1692 to Marilyn Monroe's list of New Year's resolutions from 1955, with its heartbreaking conclusion, "Try to enjoy myself when I can. I'll be miserable enough as it is." When we reached Sean Usher, I asked him why we write lists.
You know, everyone's so busy these days that to make a list kind of makes my day easier. As soon as I get up in the morning, I make a list and it kind of sets me off for the day. If I didn't make lists, I'd be just a mess. Everything would be chaotic and I wouldn't get anything done. It just makes life a bit more manageable, I suppose. And we're kind of fearful of the unknown, human beings, and to kind of label things and put them into little groups and lists makes us feel kind of content. We're all critics, so we love to rank things. We, you know, best to worst, favorite to least favorite. There's so many reasons we write lists. And it's also something, I mean, this came about from when I was doing letters of notes. So I was searching through all these archives full of beautiful letters written by amazing people. I kept finding lists written by the same people, more often, in fact, than I was finding letters, because everyone writes lists. They're so functional, you know, even in the digital age. It's not like they're being replaced by digital lists. We still have to write these lists. And with letters, you're always expecting someone to be reading the letter, at least one more person, at least the recipient. But with lists, they're often very, very private. You know, they're meant to be read only by yourself. So it's a really insightful way to learn about history and people themselves.
Yeah, there is a sense that you're sort of spying on people's thought process in some kind of way. Where do you see that in these lists?
Oh, my goodness, there's so many. I love lists that kind of reveal a different side to someone, particularly famous people. A list reveals something amazing about them, or not so amazing when it comes to Albert Einstein, who obviously is one of the cleverest people ever to have lived. But he wrote a list in 1914, at which point his marriage was failing. And he said to his wife, "I will only continue our marriage if you agree to this list of demands, this list of conditions." And she did. She agreed to it. And it's a really kind of oppressive, misogynistic list. Things like, "You'll make sure that my clothes and laundry are kept in good order. You'll make sure that I receive my meals regularly in my room. You will stop talking to me if I request it." Just this horrible, horrible list that really kind of showed me something I'd never previously known about Einstein. I love lists that kind of reveal that side of people.
You will obey the following points in your relations with me. You will not expect any intimacy from me, nor will you approach me in any way. It was a real image buster for me. I mean, I have this very different picture of Albert Einstein. And similarly, a ledger of George Washington's slaves, you know, Ben Franklin's drinker's dictionary. These are things that sort of changed my images of these people.
I know, and but the George Washington list of slaves, I mean, it's not news to most people that he had slaves, but to see it written in list form, it suddenly kind of adds another dimension to the whole experience. It really kind of brings it home.
Well, also fascinating to me was that you see Kurt Cobain's list of things needed for the Smells Like Teen Spirit video, or Picasso's list of artists for the groundbreaking Armory show. You realize that great things often begin with lists.
That's right. Even the most mundane lists kind of build up into the most incredible moments. There's one, I don't know why I just thought of this one, actually, but there's a list by Walt Disney.
Just as they were making the 50 Dwarfs?
Yeah, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. So it's adapted from the Brothers Grimm original story, in which the dwarves were nameless. So Walt Disney and his gang, his team, came up with this kind of long list of 50 potential names for the dwarves, most of which are horrendous. Like they sound really terrible. But it's only because we now know which ones were chosen. We're kind of used to them. But it's names like Helpful, Wistful, Puffy, Biggie Wiggy, Big O Ego, Sneezy Weezy. But I adore lists that kind of show you an alternative universe, you know, what could have been. Which brings to mind, actually, there's a list by Selznick Pictures, I think it was voted the most famous movie line in history. Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. The censors deemed that the word damn was too rude. So the producers of the film came up with these alternatives to what is now, you know, this incredible movie moment. And some of them are really, really terrible. Like, as you go down the list, this is typewritten list. As you go down the list, they get worse and worse. So it starts off with, frankly, my dear, I don't care. Frankly, my dear, it leaves me cold. But then you get to the bottom and it's got things like, frankly, my dear, I've withdrawn from the battle. Frankly, my dear, the whole thing is a stench in my nostrils. And the last one is, frankly, my dear, it makes my gorge rise. You can tell they were really clutching at straws as they got to the bottom of the list. Thankfully for everyone, the censors kind of agreed to let them use the word damn.
The book is just unbelievably entertaining, but it is also sort of museum-like in some ways. There's an inventory of gifts given to Queen Elizabeth I, H.P. Lovecraft's weird ideas, Thomas Edison's lists of things doing and to be done that go on for pages and pages and pages. Why did you let them go? Were you determined to present the lists exactly as they were? Tell me about that decision.
There's no way I could live with myself had I kind of edited these lists and cut them off at certain points, because the whole beauty of the lists is to produce them in their entirety. Otherwise, you're not producing the list at all, I think. This brings to mind Georges Perec, the French novelist, who was obsessed with lists. I mean, he lived his life by lists. I had so many to choose from his lists, but I chose what is called in the book Attempt at an Inventory. And the full title of it, according to Georges Perec, is Attempt at an Inventory of the Liquid and Solid Foodstuffs Ingurgitated by Me in the Course of the Year 1974. And it is literally just a huge, I mean, it spans, I think it's about five pages, a huge list of all the things he digested. If you take it without context, it's very mundane and just means absolutely nothing. But I really kind of admire the fact that he kind of kept up with this game, and I for some reason I find it really quite beautiful. And it wouldn't have worked had I just kind of reproduced one paragraph. So it's very important to me to kind of reproduce every single list.
Some of them are really interesting historical documents as well. From the 19th century, reasons for admission to a West Virginia hospital for the insane. Some of the reasons: female disease, laziness, marriage of son, sunstroke, suppressed masturbation, vicious vices in early life. Where did you find this?
That was one of the easy ones, actually. I think it was... Where did I find that? I think I just found it online. It went viral online a couple of years ago, and I just couldn't believe my luck. This was just as I was searching for all these amazing lists, and that one cropped up on my, I think it was on my Twitter feed. So that was a very easy one. So I got in touch with the asylum, or what is now, it used to be an asylum anyway. I got in touch with the people who work there now, and they verified that it was authentic.
What is the oldest list that you found?
There's one from 1250 BC, which was found in the Valley of the Kings, where they made the pyramids. And it's a list of excuses that the workers gave for their absence. So it's basically like nothing's changed. Well, things have changed, actually, because there's things like, oh, he was ill. He was fixing a door at home, that kind of stuff. But then you get to one that says he was embalming his mother. He was wrapping up his dead sister. So it's the mundane mixed with what is now seems just absolutely, you know, mind boggling.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and I'm speaking with Sean Usher. He's creator and founder of Letters of Note and now Lists of Note, projects that both started as online archives and have since been collected into gorgeously rendered coffee table volumes. Just before the break, Sean was telling me about Lists of Note, which includes illuminating records left behind by Albert Einstein, Pablo Picasso, Walt Disney, Roald Dahl, and dozens, dozens more. Sean, what was the most difficult list for you to get a hold of, or maybe the most surprising?
The one that kind of surprised me most was the there's a list called Integrated Bus Suggestions. And this was, it's never been really reproduced in full before, and it sits in the Martin Luther King archives. And this was written in 1956. It was written by Martin Luther King. And it's a list of advice, very practical advice, for black people who were getting back on the buses. This is when they were allowed to get back on the buses. It's things like, not all white people are opposed to integrated buses. Accept goodwill on the part of many. Do not deliberately sit by a white person unless there's no other seat. If cursed, do not curse back. If pushed, do not push back. If struck, do not strike back. But evidence love and goodwill at all times. It's just, I mean, there's like 17 different bits of advice in this amazing list, and I just, that really surprised me, the fact that it wasn't, you know, just everywhere. I couldn't believe it.
One of the things that I think struck me the most was these notes to self for personal conduct, you know, things that probably all of us have written at some point, but by Marilyn Monroe and by Sylvia Plath, by Johnny Cash. What gets revealed to you in reading a list like that?
It's people's kind of private moments. So, well, with the Johnny Cash one, in fact, the Johnny Cash list, which is the first one in the book, and this was a to-do list he wrote. This is the first one I found that made me think there was a future for this project, because I was just so utterly charmed by this kind of private moment where he's obviously having a joke. It's on a pre-printed sheet of kind of to-do list letterhead. At the top it's printed, things to do today. 1, not smoke. 2, kiss June. That was his wife. 3, not kiss anyone else. 4, cough. 5, pee. 6, eat. 7, not eat too much. 8, worry. 9, go see mama. 10, practice piano. And then at the bottom is printed notes, and he's written under that, don't write notes. I found it in an auction house. This list had been up for sale, up for auction a few years ago. And I just continued to search through this auction house's archives, and I found all sorts of lists. I found a list written by JFK's secretary, Evelyn Lincoln. She was in the motorcade when JFK was shot dead. And on the flight back to the White House, she wrote out a list of suspects. It's worth reading.
Tell me about some of those, because it was stunning to me. I think Lyndon Johnson's name is just above the KKK, if I'm remembering correctly.
Exactly. So at the very top is Lyndon, then it's KKK, then Dixiecrats, Hoffa, Jimmy Hoffa, John Birch Society, Nixon, Diem, which is the South Vietnamese leader, whose name I will not try and pronounce, rightist, CIA in Cuban fiasco, and then at the bottom it says dictators and communists. And it's all handwritten on this piece of card, and on the back she's written a note. It says, there is no end to the list of suspected conspirators to President Kennedy's murder. Many factions had their reasons for wanting the young president dead. That fact alone illustrates how the world suffers from a congenital proclivity to violence. And this was up for auction, I think it was about 5 years ago, and it didn't even sell. You know, I think it just went under everyone's radar. And I came across this, and I came across the Johnny Cash one in the same sort of week, I think. And I was just completely blown away. And I just knew there was legs to this project.
Well, Johnny Cash's list, you know, it's kind of humorous. It's kind of tongue in cheek. He certainly doesn't sign it. But in the case of, you know, there's no artifice. There's no pretense. There's no sense of an historical legacy for any of these. Do you think that was on the mind of any famous people? Like Woody Guthrie, his list of New Year's resolutions, it seems a little more intended for an audience.
Yeah, and to some extent, I think Johnny Cash's was, because it's quite humorous, I can't see myself writing that kind of list were it just for myself. You know, he's clearly expecting someone to read it. But Woody Guthrie, I think, is the same. There's just a lovely mix. There's a absolutely heartbreaking list written by a lady called Hilary North, who worked in the Twin Towers. But on the morning of the planes going into the Twin Towers, she didn't make it to work, and all her colleagues died when the planes hit. And she wrote this list afterwards of all the things she was going to miss about her colleagues, and it's the most heartbreaking lists, and you just can't imagine what she was going through when she wrote that list. You know, it's just, I just love the fact that there's such a mixture of lists in the book. Some that are intended for audiences, some that weren't. Some are funny, some are sad, some are really kind of historically significant. There's kind of something for everyone.
So, Sean Usher, letters of note, lists of note. Where do you go to next?
I've just finished Letters of Note 2, which will be out very soon. And I'm just starting work on my next project, which is Speeches of Note. So I've done letters, lists, speeches, and then I've got other options after that as well.
You'll have to just start a list.
Basically, yeah.
Well, Sean Usher, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
You'll find much more on Sean Usher's book, Lists of Note, an eclectic collection deserving of a wider audience, at wordmouthradio.org. Of the many lists featured in Usher's collection is the Ten Commandments of Guitar Playing by the avant-garde rocker Don Van Vliet, better known as Captain Beefheart. While Beefheart, who died in 2010, never really achieved commercial success, his influence in the music business is undeniable. Beefheart gave his Ten Commandments to a member of his rotating ensemble, the Magic Band, sometime in the late 1970s. Here are just a few excerpts. 1, listen to the birds. That's where all the music comes from. 2, your guitar is not really a guitar. Your guitar is a divining rod. Use it to find spirits in the other worlds and bring them over. 3, practice in front of a bush. Wait until the moon is out, then go outside. Eat a multi-grained bread and play your guitar to a bush. If the bush doesn't shake, eat another piece of bread. Years before he crafted his Ten Commandments of Guitar Playing, Captain Beefheart crafted his most famous album, 1969's Trout Mask Replica. The album is a wild mix of free jazz, blues, and beat poetry. In this piece, produced by Devin Strolovich, we'll hear about the making of Trout Mask Replica and learn why it was so influential.
My name is John French, and I was the drummer in the Magic Band, and also the transcriber of probably 70 to 80% of the music, which I also taught to the other players.
My name's Mike Barnes. I'm the author of the book Captain Beefheart.
Tom Waits, musician. Prepare yourself for a glimpse into the future. These are like recipes for curatives, ancient oils.
The black paper between a mirror breaks my heart. The moon frayed through dark velvet lightly apart. Steals softly through sunshine. Steals softly through snow.
When people hear Captain Beefheart's music for the first time, it can be quite a daunting prospect, because what you had was quite a harsh and quite a dissonant sound that you'd probably only heard in free jazz albums before. It was the first time, really, that you'd heard that kind of structure in rock music.
It's so unlike anything that we all consider music to be. And to dance to this, there aren't really any existing dances appropriate.
Steal softly through sunshine, steal softly through snow.
I met Don Van Vliet and the Magic Band, all the members, the same night, and I was asked to join in around October of 1966. I was in a different generation than these guys. These guys came out of the 50s, you know, with rock and roll and doo-wop music, hot rods and pachuco clothes and haircuts. You know, they were sort of the badass kind of guys. I got girl, did it, won't did it.
Well, you can hear his influences, which is interesting. Always, Howlin' Wolf is very present. I wore my 44 so long. I
made my shoulder so. But by the time Captain Beefheart got to Troutmaster Replica, which was recorded in 1969, he decided to employ a different compositional process.
It starts out with Frownland, which is just total chaos.
It sounds like it's been made up on the spot, but in fact it was rigorously learnt, so the players would play the tracks the same way every time.
With musicians, a lot of the time, what they really need to do is unlearn it. For myself, the first time I heard Troutmaster, I had to stop and pause and look at what it was that I was doing that I thought was interesting, relevant, or worthwhile. I just had never encountered anything filled with so much abandon.
Now here she come walking, looking like a zoo. Hiella, hiella guru.
It was hard to believe that it was actually conducted and designed.
I think John French deserves a lot of credit for his role in the realization of Troutmaster Replica, because without his diligent work on it, transcribing piano lines or trying to make sense of a number of tapes that Don Van Vliet had made of whistling, scat singing, I think if he hadn't been able to do that, it just could easily not have worked at all.
You're talking about people playing in different keys, different time signatures, all at the same time, and you had to figure out how to end and start each section together.
And then fly apart again. Like one of those moments in a large gathering where everyone's talking at the same time, and then all of a sudden there's a moment of silence, and you don't know, it couldn't have been predicted. Fast and bulbous. And then the talking starts again.
Fast and bulbous.
That's right, the mascara snake. Fast and bulbous.
Bulbous also tapered.
Yeah, but you've got to wait until I say. Also, a tin teardrop.
Oh, Christ.
The circumstances under which Troutmaster Replica was rehearsed were certainly not conditions I would like to have been in myself. They were in grinding poverty and they had a very harsh work regime. Beefheart would, for instance, deprive people of sleep. He would keep them up all night.
He would have these talks. He'd call it, oh, John's got a thing, like a hang-up or a problem, and we've got to talk about this, so we'd sit down and the talks would sometimes erupt into violence. So it became a very uncomfortable and paranoid situation.
Captain Beefheart himself said about Troutmaster Replica, let it come to you, play it whilst you're washing up the dishes or doing the housework. There is a logic to it. It's just trying to get used to a sort of different musical language.
The one thing that I think Don was able to bring into the whole equation, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but he didn't know what he was doing. Captain Beefheart realized the possibilities that existed in music if you looked past the rules.
Like a bee trapped in an outhouse while a man changes a tire and a plane passes over and Jay is yammering and a skateboard comes by and hits all the cracks right on time.
And that piece on Captain Beefheart's seminal album, Troutmaster Replica, was produced by Devin Strolovich. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org, including the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe there at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And please, if you like the podcast, tell a friend or write a review. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on New Hampshire Public Radio.